When I was looking at wedding cakes 30-some years ago, decorating them with fresh flowers was a newish trend. In fact, there were flowers on the wedding cake my husband and I had. These were something that would be taken off and set aside when it came time to cut the cake, though. Today, you can find flowers garnishing all sorts of foods in haute cuisine, and any chef who knows their stuff will use flowers that you can eat. If you'd like to grow your own, well, there's a book coming out about that. I'm Shauna Doby, editor of Canada's Local Gardener magazine. Erin Bunting is the cooking part of the duo behind The Edible Flower, a new cook and gardening book she wrote with her wife, Jo Facer. I talked with Erin recently about edible flowers and let her and their book inspire me to grow violas and dianthus and roses in my garden this year. One more thing before we get going. I'd like to invite you to send me an email about how you like the podcast. Tell me what you think I should cover and if you know any experts, real, true experts in a subject I should talk to. My email is shauna@pegasuspublications.net, and I'll repeat that at the end of the podcast too. And now let me introduce you to Erin Bunting.
My name's Erin Bunting and I am a cook and recipe developer and food stylist. And with my wife, Jo, I own a small holding, an organic small holding in the Drumlins of County Down, which is in Northern Ireland. Drumlins are little kind of humpbacked hills in a lovely rural setting about 10 miles south of Belfast. And from our small holding, we do lots of different things. We run supper clubs, so that's like pop-up dining events where people come and communally eat together and have a lovely experience on the farm using lots of our own produce that we grow there. We also run some classes, cooking and gardening and brewing, all different things that we're interested in. And then we also run a community supported agriculture scheme, a CSA scheme, which is like a veg box scheme, but more involved, where our customers buy into a share of the produce that we grow on our farm for the season. And they share in the risks and rewards of small organic farming. And also part of our scheme is that everyone comes together about once a month and we have a big kind of community day where we do lots of farm tasks and some fun tasks for kids. And then we also have a big meal together and everyone enjoys it. Broadly within our relationship, I am the cook and my wife is the more of a focus on kind of the growing the vegetables and the flowers as well, obviously.
Wow. And you're all of what, 35 or something?
A little bit older than that. I'm 41.
How did you figure out to do all that?
It's a bit of a journey. So we met at university and we've been together ever since. So when we were 20 and we both went and had separate, completely different careers in London. I'm from Northern Ireland originally. My wife is from London. We moved to London. I did history of art and architecture and then worked in kind of arts and event management. And my wife did engineering and then she went and worked in property development. So we had these completely different careers. And then about 2015, it had been stirring in our minds for a while. She'd always had this belief that one day we'd move to the countryside and grow our own food and things. And it was somewhere percolating around there. So then in our mid-30s, I spent a lot of time facilitating other people being creative and I was really interested in food. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to change my career and become a cook or a chef. I prefer the word cook, but become a cook. So I retrained. I went to a big organic cookery school down south called Ballymaloe. And I did their 3-month kind of residential course and just changed my career, basically became a cook. After I came back and I worked in London for a bit and we were still thinking about things and we started running supper clubs we had a little terrace house in East London, started running supper clubs just as a way of kind of testing our ideas. I was doing the cooking. Jo was doing a lot of brewing at that time, brewing beer. So she would brew beer and we'd do some beer and food matching and it was all very small scale, like 10 people. And so we were doing that for a while. And then we thought, now it's time to make the move. England is very expensive, south of England, which is where we were living, to own land. And we just didn't really have that kind of capital. So we decided to move back to Northern Ireland, which is where I'm from, and where it's always more affordable for us to be able to buy a small holding and to make that kind of thing work. So it was really just really trying out some things and stuff. When we came back here, we started running some supper clubs and then we bought our small holding and then we started running supper clubs from the small holding and also from other people's venues as well. And then just Jo started growing vegetables. She did some courses and helped out at some other farms and learned a lot about growing organically. We grow organically and no dig principles. And so it was just through that really. And then just things grew slowly really with word of mouth and people being interested in what we were doing. And I guess coming to our events, people can get a bit of a slice of that kind of good by being part of our scheme, our farm fee scheme, or coming to our events or coming to our volunteering days and stuff without the commitment of maybe not everyone actually wants to like leave their jobs and, you know, move out of the city. So.
Can you imagine buying a plot of land and starting your life over? It seems to be a special sort of person who will just start something completely new in their 30s, open a restaurant, start a farm. We have people like that in Canada too, of course, and you may be one of them. Is it that they're entrepreneurs? I looked up traits of entrepreneurs online. There are 4, 6, 7, 14 different types. I think that to get a degree in business right now, you have to have a theory about what kind of people are entrepreneurs. Many articles say you must be creative, but that doesn't account for people who open franchises or become landlords. They say you need to develop a deep passion, but one passion I've found that entrepreneurs have is the passion to win. Empathetic? No way. I think the entrepreneurial spirit is not too far removed from the narcissistic personality. I think these start a new life types are just people who want something different from what they have, and they want it so much that they'll go and get it. The conditions you've got there are probably a good deal milder than what we face here, particularly on the prairies in Canada. Mm-hmm. So tell me what the weather is like where you are today.
Actually, weirdly today, there was a small amount of snow, which is like quite late in the season for us. But yes, we are much milder. Actually, it's so interesting. A really good friend of mine who I went to cookery school with is based in Edmonton, and she runs a cooking business there. It's a cafe and a cookery school called On Kitchen. She grows her own veg as well. And she's always like, I'm like, I just went out to pick some bay leaves. And she's like, oh, bay leaves don't survive over the winter here. So yeah, very aware of that different season. But yeah, today it was cold and frosty, clear skies, and then we had a little flurry of snow, but we are definitely moving well into the springtime here, really. Lots of the flowers.
But you can grow a good deal more than we can here, and possibly a little bit more than they can in Southern Ontario, and probably not as much as they can in British Columbia, which is the envy of us all. It really is. Can you grow lemons where you are?
No, it's probably too cold for us, the lemons here. Maybe in the south of England. You might know my mother-in-law has a lemon tree and grows a few lemons in London. But yeah, pretty much too cold here.
The UK looms large in our brains owing to history, but in fact, Canada is about 40 times larger. As for the north-south position, Winnipeg is around the 50th parallel, and the southernmost point of the UK is at the same latitude. So why is it so much warmer there? Well, that is the magic of the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream is essentially a current of warm ocean water coursing from the Caribbean across the Atlantic and traveling along the west coast of Europe. It's astonishing that this could change the weather so drastically. The world is a strange and mysterious place. About the book, was it a long time in coming?
It felt like it. I'm not sure if it was actually in the grand scheme of writing a book. I'd always wanted to write a book, just full stop, from I was a child. I'm a massive bookworm. I'm always reading. I love books. I think there's something magical about them. So I always had this idea in my head, I would love to write a book. And then once I became a cook, I was like, I'd like to write a recipe book. And we've been talking to a friend of ours who actually took the photographs for the book. She transitioned from being a product photographer to a food photographer. And she was saying, I'd love to do a book. We should write a proposal together. And then we could do one. And so we'd been having this conversation during lockdown, the first lockdown in 2020. And just as things were opening up, we did a couple of photo shoots outside where we took some nice food photographs, and we were thinking, pull a proposal together. And actually, while that was happening, someone approached us about writing this book. Lawrence King, who are the publishers, approached us. They were looking for someone to write who was a sort of growing cooking partnership to write a book that was about growing edible flowers and then using them in food. Mm-hmm. And so it just was very serendipitous. We'd done a bit of work and thinking about it. So then when they asked us to write a proposal, we had some content for that. So then it took 9 months to get it agreed. And then it took a year to write a photograph. And it was quite an interesting process because lots of cookbooks, and maybe less so with gardening books because they probably do have to always be seasonal, but lots of cookbooks, you would write the book and then at the very end, you would do the photographs. So you'd get into a studio and you'd take all the photographs. But because it was all about cooking with flowers, like seasonally through the year, you couldn't be taking photographs of magnolias in autumn time. We needed to take the photos of the magnolias in March or April. So we had to write it and photograph it as we went along, which was challenging because it was the first time we'd ever done it. And we just did it between us. I did the food styling and Sharon did the photographs, and we didn't have loads of other input. Obviously the publisher gave us feedback. That must have been the whole of 2021. And then 2022 was proofreading and copy editing. And then eventually it came out in I think we pretty much finished everything at the end of August 2022.
I was going to comment that the photographs were really lovely. And that's great that you already knew somebody who would be able to take such beautiful pictures.
We're very lucky. We got her to know her through our events, and she used to come and take photographs, or still does come and take photographs at our events. But yeah, I think she learned a lot about taking photographs of plants, because obviously that's a different skill to taking photographs of food. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Plants and gardens, I can take pictures of. Anything else? Not so much, maybe. Our president, Ian Leet, is working on a cookbook right now. If you get our weekly digest, Flora and Fauna, of which this podcast is a part, there is a recipe of his in every single issue. He used to be a chef on the Gulf island of Jersey between Britain and France. He doesn't have a food stylist or a food photographer working on it, but the pictures he takes of the food are just beautiful. Don't know if you can speak to this at all, but in your 3-year plan to start an edible garden, you do it in a kind of interesting way, which is you don't add the verticals and the woody perennials until year 3.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I think when Joe was writing this, because Joe wrote the section, but really when we were talking about it and writing it, she was saying for her, it was just about making it as manageable as possible for people. She feels like she's a teacher as well. So now, obviously, we run our own courses and things like that, teach people about growing things. And also she runs a course at the local college around kind of organic fruit and veg. And she just says that often people come in and they're like, they've never grown anything before, some people, and they feel overwhelmed by how many things you have to do. For her, it was very much about breaking down that into kind of manageable chunks that people feel they could achieve within a year. But also for her, she's all about understanding the aspect of your garden. Where are the dry spots? Where are the damp spots? Where gets sun? All those types of things that will affect the success of your garden. If you're already experienced and you think, yeah, I've come to this new space, I know this is going to be a good spot, blah, blah. But for her, you know, if it's the beginning, it's better for you to get to know that space before you commit to some of those bigger verticals and stuff. Though we would definitely say from the book that it's also super useful for people who already have established gardens. If you're already a great gardener and you're probably already growing quite a lot of these edibles in your garden, you're maybe not using them in the kitchen, or you can easily introduce them into an existing space. But yeah, I feel like hopefully I've adequately described what she was thinking, making it accessible to people, but also understanding your aspect and your soil and what grows well, where, and things like that.
I found it interesting myself. I've just moved to Winnipeg from Ontario, and the climate is really very different. It gets so cold here in the winter, but you can grow a lot. But I'm about to start my own garden, and I don't know where to start.
Yeah.
I have all these ideas for what I want, and I think, well, I've got to get the apple trees. I've got to put in apple trees right away, because those will take a long time to get growing, and I've got to put raspberries in right away. But this really puts it into perspective. If you start with some annuals, so you lose a year of growth on your apple trees or whatever, 2 years, but it's not that big of a deal in the long run, is it?
Yeah, and especially if you put the apple tree in the wrong place, and then you're like, oh, that's annoying. That can move things to some extent.
When I was looking at the recipes, I've got to say that I've seen a number of books and written articles on edible flowers. And up until now, I don't really like to eat flowers. I know that I shouldn't say that as a gardening magazine editor, but I've got to say that your book had my mouth watering.
Okay.
It all looks so delicious. When it comes to starting my own new garden, I really should follow Joe's method of starting with annuals instead of apple trees. The last time I started a garden was almost 30 years ago. We had no money and a tiny yard. I just started removing sod and then put in soil and plants. I didn't plan it. But this time, there is so much more to get wrong. Our yard is lovely. Add to that, I want to try everything I talk about in the podcast and write about for Canada's Local Gardener. I am definitely growing sweet potatoes this year and garlic in the fall, and it just goes on and on. I'll have to use the lasagna method to build the new border in the backyard, put down newspaper, add several inches of topsoil and mulch, then I can plant directly into that. But what about the Ruth Stout method of putting down seed potatoes on the lawn and just adding inches and inches of dead leaves and straw on top of that? At the end of the growing season, I'll have loads of potatoes and a rich bed for next year. But can I wait that long? The nasturtium capers. I've heard that you can do this, and I've wanted to do it for a long time. I'm not sure I can wrap my head around canning things yet, though. Could I do it without the canning process?
Yes, because it's a vinegar pickle. You're grand. You don't need to can it. It'll keep you probably just make it and keep it in the fridge, basically. And it'll probably stay good in the fridge for a year. But I would say probably eat it within 3 months just to be safe. But because it's a vinegar pickle, it'll stay with lots of those things, those kind of more quick pickle where you're using a vinegar rather than fermenting necessarily. There's so much acid in there that things aren't going to go off. But the quality of the thing will degrade slightly over time. It'll get like slightly softer and slightly less delicious. But actually those pickled nasturtium capers keep really well. And I've definitely used them like 6 months after I've made them and they've still been great.
According to the blog Fun Flower Facts, nasturtium seeds were used as a substitute for black pepper during World War II, and the name means nose twister in Latin, which comes from a person's reaction to tasting the flowers. The name does mean twisted nose in Latin, but I cannot truly confirm that the seeds were ever used in place of black pepper, either during the war or at any other time. In fact, a blogger tried using the seeds this way and found the results disappointing. Fun idea, though. Roasted grapes. I haven't heard about those being used in modern times. I've read old recipes that involve cooking grapes. So I was really impressed because we started making our own raisins this year.
Delicious.
So are roasted grapes popular where you are, or did you come up with that?
Not really that popular, but I definitely have seen a few recipes in the last couple of years. We quite often get these really nice muscat grapes from Italy in the fall and the autumn time here, and they're so delicious roasted. But yeah, I just think like you just bring out loads of sweetness. You're not getting to raisin stage, but you're just intensifying that sweetness. And that recipe is so good with the gorgonzola style cheese, like a blue cheese, and then the Dahlia Pearls, which have this kind of slightly, it depends on the Dahlia actually, it varies a bit, but lots of them have this sort of slightly celery, a little bit of bitterness, a little bit of nuttiness, and that goes really well with the combination of flavors in that recipe, yeah.
If you've never heard of roasting grapes, you should give it a try. You know when you buy grapes at the store and they're not sweet enough to enjoy them? The answer is to roast them a bit and enjoy the result as a condiment to meat or a spoon over for ice cream. A number of recipes online say to toss them in oil and roast them at 425, but we put them at a lower oven for a longer time without oil. Of course, grapes aren't a flower. The roasted grapes were used in a recipe called roasted Swede and grape salad with blue cheese and Dahlia petals. So how did you get into cooking with flowers? Has it something you've always done? Or?
No, not really. As a child, was my mom grew nasturtiums and violas and things like that, and we would have torn them up over salads and things like that. And then when I retrained at Ballymaloe, they're quite interested in cooking. Their whole philosophy is very much about using seasonally, and they're based on an organic farm. And even though I went and retrained in the wintertime, they were still talking about flowers that you could use. They have big glass houses there and stuff. So we were using calendulas, and we were using preserved rose petals, and we were using sweet geranium, which is actually a leaf, but I've got it in the book because it has floral aspects to it. And so it just really whetted my appetite. I remember just when we were making salads there, you just get a couple of edible flowers and you make this beautiful green salad. They were growing beautiful greens anyway, absolutely gorgeous wintergreen salad leaves. And just that little pop of like calendula petals over the top of it, it really transformed it. It lifted it from something. And it also, for me, it went away from the aspect I don't really like about edible flowers is you go to a very fancy restaurant and someone has placed one tiny flower on the edge of your pate or whatever, and it's just there for decoration. And for me, that wasn't, whereas this is, you're using the flower for the flavor and you're using it for its beauty, and it's relaxed, casual, communal food, which is the type of food I like to cook, and which is hopefully what comes across in the book.
Sprinkling edible petals over salad seems like a good way to start eating flowers. Think of it. A few calendula petals in your salad would not be such a commitment and would add beautiful color. Now we're going to take a quick break to catch up with Ian at HQ, but we'll be back to hear more from Aaron Bunting.
Canada's local gardener just got even better. Flora and Fauna, a new e-digest coming weekly. Go to localgardener.net to find out more information. That's localgardener.net.
Welcome back. In her book, Edible Flowers, Erin uses a flower that I didn't know was edible. Tulip petals, they're good to eat?
Yes, they are. Surprisingly. I didn't know it until a few years ago, not prior to writing this book, but obviously once we called our business The Edible Flower, and we were growing lots of edible flowers, and we also call it The Edible Flower because almost all the food that we eat comes from flowering plants. So that, for us, that was part of the ethos behind our business. It's about, it's We're not entirely plant-based, but we're very much focused on eating plants. I've discovered tulips are edible, and we grow these green tulips, which are like a perennial tulip. They're a great sort of crisp, just a hint of nuttiness, flavor, a bit like a baby gem lettuce or something like that.
Ooh, imagine a dinner party where their pièce de résistance was dessert, a tulip bloom without the pistil and stamens, filled with a delicious lemon mousse. If you look online, a number of websites will claim that all parts of the tulip are poisonous because they contain tulipolins. Tulipolins are a common allergen inducing dermatitis in people, and people sensitive should avoid coming into contact with the bulbs. Nonetheless, tulip petals are generally considered edible. What would you say is your favorite flower to eat?
Oh, it's so difficult to say. I love them all. But favorite flower to eat? I think for flavor and surprisingness, I love magnolia. It has this amazing, like, gingery, citrusy flavor. It's so, when you pickle it, there's a recipe for pickling it in there. It's like pickled ginger that you have with sushi. It's incredible. So really? I love it. It's just like such, and it has such a nice short little season. So it's a great one to use. And also it's a season for us here where there's still not much produce around. So it's always wonderful. And then I love nasturtiums. I just think they bring me so much joy. The colors of them, the way they trail, they just grow everywhere on our farm, and they, you can use all of them. We use the flowers, the petals pulled off into salads or stirred through things, or I do petals into batter. There's a recipe for kind of like courgette fritters in there. But, and like I make a garlic, it's not in the book, but I make a garlic bread where I put loads of nasturtium petals through the butter, and that makes, you put it, that looks so gorgeous. And when you slice it up, because it's got all this kind of like beautiful little petals. And then also you can pickle a caper. You can use the little seed heads, make the pickled capers, and then the leaves make an amazing like salsa verde. It's just like a great plant all year round. Not all year round because it's tender, but the whole season you can use it all the time.
Now I'm just dying to eat a magnolia bloom. The problem? Magnolia is not hardy in Winnipeg. Certainly not the saucer magnolias used in Aaron's book. But I might be able to get a smaller star magnolia to struggle through a few years here, and it may bloom after some very mild spring. So I looked up star magnolias online. The only thing I found on the taste of the flowers was a Reddit post from someone asking about the taste of the flowers. The poster commented that they couldn't find anything online about the taste either. You mentioned beach roses, which is Rosa rugosa. Is it the single flower concept with one row of petals around it? Is that what makes Rosa rugosa good for cooking, or is it something else?
Really, any roses are edible, but we've got quite a lot planted on the farm and we just use it as a hedge. And so it has like multi-purpose. But also Rosa rugosa is really nicely scented. Not all commercial varieties of rosa scented. Obviously, if you do get a really delicious tea rose or something that's got beautiful scent, you should also use that. But for us, Rosa rugosa, you just put it in. It makes a great hedge. It has a beautiful scent. It grows really well in loads of environments, you know, beach rose. So it can grow in a salty environment, beach side environment as well. And I suppose one of the great things about using Rosa rugosa is the great smell, but also when you're picking the petals off, we talk a bit about this in the book, because it's that simple thing. It's really easy to pick the petals off and leave the center, and then you still get the hip, which Rosa rugosa hips are also really great for cooking. And they're particularly great for cooking because they're like really fat and round, whereas some rose hips are much kind of thinner and seedier. There's quite a lot of flesh on a Rosa rugosa hip, and we really like using it to make ketchups and rose hip syrup and rose hip jelly and things like that as well. So it's dual purpose. You're getting the use of the rose and the thing. And also Rosa rugosa, the pink one, the white one too is beautiful, but the pink one, it's gorgeous colored pink petals, which, you know, dry really nicely and then can be used. You can dehydrate them or dry them in the oven and then grind them up, and you get a bit of pink color as well as the nice rose flavor. But all roses are edible, so if you know it's a rose, you can eat it.
For sure. We've got a number of wild roses in Canada, so I was wondering how those would work out.
I'm sure that, I think if they've got a good smell, then they'll be great for cooking.
Yeah. Rosa woodsia would probably be the tastiest native rose, given its sweet scent. The hips aren't huge, so if you're going to harvest them, you'll need to either boil them and throw out the used hips, or spend a lot of time cutting them and scooping out the seeds. Rose seeds are covered in tiny hairs that cause nasty itching, and if you eat them, you'll get what some indigenous groups call itchy bum disease. Are there any flowers that you hate to cook with?
Oh, there's definitely some that I thought about putting in the book and then changed my mind about. Grape hyacinth is edible.
Is it?
Springtime flower, yes.
Sorry, yeah.
A muscaria, exactly. And I was kicking with it last year. I definitely had known it was edible. And I was like, I grow it in my garden. I was like, I'm going to do some kicking with it. But it's very bitter. I did manage to make a very nice kind of jelly with a sort of milk layer. And then I actually have a similar recipe in the book with chamomile. And I was like, I'm going to try that. And it has the most fabulous color. The muscaria gives up this beautiful, deep, bluey color. And then it has the same aspect as lots of those blue flowers that are edible. If you put acid with them, then they go pink, purple. So it had this most beautiful color, but even with the sugar and various balancing, I was like, I still think that's not that palatable. So that was definitely one that I was like, maybe I'll put that in another book or write some recipes around that. And then I was like, I think maybe it's a bit too divisive. So yeah, probably that one. There definitely are quite a lot of, I think with all things, there's lots of things that you will read are edible. You won't see them commonly used probably because they have quite a bit bitter flavor and that's puts people off. And also I think with all flowers, when you're eating them, if you're exploring that world outside of what's in our book, which definitely are edible, and there are some warnings in there if there's certain issues, if you're taking certain medication or you're pregnant and things like that, if you're exploring that world, like I always think with these things, when you're eating something new, you should just try a bit and see how it is, because not everyone can eat everything.
Oh, you mean allergies?
Yeah, I just mean allergies. And sometimes people are, I think with all foods, if it's the first time you've tried something, just try a little bit of it before you fill your whole plate with it.
Sunflower is another flower you can eat. You need to harvest the buds when they're fully formed, but before they open at all. Boil and simmer them until they are tender, and then get to work peeling off all the outside hairy bits and the inner portion of petals and pre-seeds. You can eat what's left, either right away or after stir-frying, or you can use them in some other way. Apparently, the taste is strongly vegetal. Honestly, that doesn't sell it to me. Are there any that are finicky to deal with?
So borage is actually one of my favorites. It has a beautiful cucumbery flavor, but it is a little bit tricky because it's quite prickly. The leaves and foliage are quite prickly. So you just need to be a bit careful when you're harvesting it, to wear some gloves or be very careful with what you're having. And then whenever I'm harvesting it, it has a lovely little blue star shape, and there's a kind of hairy sort of sepal bit on the back. You need to remove that if you're going to eat it, because it's not very nice to eat the hairy bit. And it's actually a pet peeve of mine seeing in restaurants when they haven't bothered to remove that. They use it quite often, and it's sometimes people don't remove that bit, and I'm like, nobody wants to eat that. So I think you should remove that bit. So yeah, that one's a bit tricky. And then also I would say I love courgette flowers, and there's quite a few recipes for courgette flowers and squash flowers in the book, but again, pretty prickly. And so the same as when you're harvesting courgettes and things like that, you just need to wear some gloves and some long sleeves so you don't get your skin irritated by those little prickles. But once you've got it, the stem cut off and things like that, you're absolutely fine. You can eat them raw or cooked.
One thing I didn't mention during our interview is using French marigolds in cooking. The idea of eating a thick, coarse head of marigold is not appealing to me at all, but Erin does have a very attractive recipe for the petals as well as a few of the leaves, which are also edible. She makes pasta and she presses them into the dough as she's rolling it out, then folds over the dough and puts the folded piece back through the pasta machine. Oh my stars, it is beautiful. She cuts the sheets into tagliatelle, just gorgeous. You use some kind of borage leaves?
Yes. So borage leaves, young borage leaves, are used quite a lot in Mediterranean cooking. I mean, maybe other places as well, but I've definitely come across them in Italian and Maltese as well cooking. And they have a kind of slightly gelatinous texture. So they're often used as a kind of thickening in stews and things like that. So yeah, you can use borage leaves. They're edible at all times, but they're nicest when they're young. So probably before they flowered, at that kind of early stage, if you've got some borage, maybe you've done some succession sowing and you've got some that are in flower and some that are earlier on. So yeah, a few of those leaves is delicious. And we added them to did a kind of like Tuscan bean ribollata, like a Tuscan bean stew with bread, and there's some borage leaves in there. And they have they similarly have a really nice cucumbery flavor. I've also used them in a raita before, using them with yogurt as a kind of alternative to cucumber. If they're hairy-ish, you need to cook them, so they need to be put into something. It's like cooking with nettles or something like that as well. As long as you put it into something hot, that will all be wilted down. But actually, if you get them really young and they're not too hairy, you'll still feel they're quite soft. You can just chop them up really finely and stir them through yogurt with a bit of mint. And actually the yogurt itself has a kind of tenderizing effect on them. And then it's delicious as a kind of raita alternative.
Of course, gardeners also grow borage as a plant to attract hornworms away from vegetables and to bring pollinators to the garden. It also blooms for weeks and has that fuzzy look that makes it just brilliant for ornamental gardens. Dianthus.
Oh, yes.
It's Now you use...
I think we talk about charophyllus in the book, yeah?
Yeah, go ahead. Tell me more about that.
All dianthus and everything in that family, like Sweet William and everything, they're all edible. But when we were writing a book, there was quite a lot of pressure to narrow down what we were focusing on. So we ended up talking about charophyllus, which we grow. But yeah, they're all edible. And they have such a fantastic flavor, carnations. Though saying all that, you do have to pick your variety, because I have taste tested a few. And I guess with they're often not bred for flavor. they're bred for their pretty colors or whatever. But some of the really small, like pinks, have an absolutely amazing clove-like flavor, and then some of the kind of multi-petaled ones as well. So it just depends on the variety. But if you get a good variety, when you taste it, it really is an exceptional flavor, quite spicy, quite clove-like. And also, if you use the nice colored pinks and reds and things like that, then you can make like absolutely amazing syrups that are both beautiful color and also this amazing kind of spicy flavor, which is a great addition to cocktails or mocktails. Or in the book, we use make a babka, which is like an enriched bread that is folded into a sort of twist, and then we use the dianthus syrup to glaze it. But also it's great glazing cakes or tarts, all sorts of different things. But yeah, you get this lovely kind of clove like flavor. And actually, it didn't make the book because we had to cut some recipes, but I made a really nice chai tea, so using the petals infused into milk to get that kind of spicy clove like flavor. And then I added a bit of cinnamon and stuff as well, and made a sort of take on a chai tea.
A dianthus syrup is very appealing to me. I love the clovey smell of the flowers, and the syrup is very easy to make. You just pour boiling water over the petals and leave them to infuse overnight, then strain them and make a simple syrup with the flavored water. In the book, Erin muddles the syrup with basil and blackberries and pours sparkling water over top, and you can mix in vodka too. I did use lavender one time and made meringues. I hated it. It tasted like soap to me. But I do know a number of people who loved it. This is one of the few plants that I've found that you can get dried cooking versions of. Do you think anybody's been trying to grow flowers for the market for cooking with?
We grow edible flowers, and obviously, and when we have excess in the seed, we give them to our veg box members. They'll get some edible flowers every week in their box, and then we also sell some excess, and I would sell if somebody needed them for a wedding cake and things like that. But there definitely are a few companies in the UK, I'm not sure about elsewhere, which is good, because coincides with my book, because actually the company I use for all my kind of dried fruits and nuts and things, that they keep sending me flyers about all this dried edible flower petals they're selling as well. So I do think there's an upward trend in it. And there's a company in England as well that does pressed flowers now. So you can buy flowers already pressed if you don't want to grow them and press them yourself. I talk about pressing flowers for cake decoration quite a lot in the book. So yeah, I think there's definitely a sort of a bit of a shift, but it's quite a tricky product to sell because the shelf life on it isn't that long. But the shelf life on salad isn't that long either. People still manage it. I guess it's a bit more of a niche product for people. But in my feeling would always be if you could grow your own, even if you have only a tiny spot, even if you only have a window box or a balcony or a tiny patio or something, and you're living in the city, like few pots, you want something that's going to be beautiful. But then you could also have something beautiful and edible, which is like such a nice thing. And if you just want to grow a couple of nasturtiums, some cornflowers, maybe a few dianthus or a little pot of lavender, you can grow those things. They're beautiful. They're amazing for biodiversity within those spaces that maybe don't have as much greenery and things like that. And then you can go out and pick a few flowers and throw them in your salad. And lots of those things are pick and come again. The more nasturtiums you pick, the more nasturtium you get, more calendula you pick, the more calendula you'll get. You're getting it by picking them to eat as well. But I was going to pick up on what you said about lavender, because I agree, sometimes people can find it a bit soupy. I do think it's a bit of a balance, and it's great when combined with other flavors. And also, I often think if it's in something sweet, you often need a good pinch of salt in there to balance that flavor. I don't like it in sweet things at all. Lavender is an amazing savory herb. We use it in various recipes in the book. Basically, you can use it where you would use rosemary. If you would use rosemary with lamb or rosemary with roasted vegetables or whatever, you can think about putting some lavender in instead. But I would say less is more with lavender. It can be quite an overwhelming flavor, so you just need to balance it right.
In the book, Erin has a box for every flower with a do, a don't, and another note on harvesting or taste. The don't for lavender is don't overuse. Thinking back to my lavender-infused meringues, I think I used too much. The idea of using lavender for savory dishes really appeals to me, though. My husband and I years ago had an amazing dinner at 11 Madison Park in New York that featured lavender-scented duck. It came out with a smoking sprig of lavender, and I thought, so that's it, because I can never taste something like a lavender scent. But this duck was perfect, and the thick layer of fat on the breast truly tasted of lavender. I was impressed. Just occurred to me, do you get the boxed lettuce there? It's in a cello box.
Yes, I know what you mean. But actually, mostly it comes in bags here, but I do know what you mean. Like a kind of clamshell type.
A clamshell box, and it's mixed lettuces and greens. Why don't they throw in a few nasturtiums in that? Because they're so easy to grow and so cheap. And I bet that would start the whole revolution.
I agree. And I think, and actually a local market grower here, they do bagged salads, like organic, beautiful, gorgeous bagged salad. And they would often throw a couple of calendula heads, so the pot marigolds in things. It adds flavor. You're eating a different plant. Do you think the more different variety of things we get into our diet, the better for our digestion and our gut biome and all those different things? And also just like, it brings you so much joy when you're doing that. You make a salad and then you throw a few orange petals over the green and it just suddenly looks wonderful.
Okay. I'll go back to trying to grow flowers for the kitchen.
I reckon just a few annuals, a couple of nasturtiums, a couple of calendula, maybe a few cornflowers. I love cornflowers. They're one of my favorites. So,
if you live in Toronto, Montreal, or Vancouver, you might have more luck finding edible flowers for sale at a downtown supermarket or a gourmet grocer. I've also found that Floating Gardens in Saskatchewan delivers edible flowers to Saskatoon and surrounding areas. For the most part, in Canada, though, you'll have to grow your own. When I grew nasturtium before, I tried a leaf and thought, I tried a flower and thought, but you really would need to mix them in.
Yeah, I think you just need to balance them with the other flavors and also think about the color and the joy on the plate. That's, I think, but nasturtium leaves are great added to a salsa verde or a kind of green sauce with some other herbs, like that will add this lovely background pepperiness.
So I just thought you were supposed to add them to your salad.
Yeah, you can just add them to your salad, but I really like using them as making a kind of salsa verde and just putting, I think there's a recipe in the book with a sort of yogurt and roasted beetroot and make a kind of nasturtium salsa verde. And then, but yeah, just all the different, whatever you're growing, a handful of mint, a handful of coriander, even if you're not growing it, like I think it's a great way to use up those half open bags of herbs that you've got in your fridge. You've got a bit of dill that you needed for a recipe and a bit of coriander you need for a recipe, and they're sitting there and you think, and then maybe half a bag of some rocket or something. Bung them all into the food processor with a bit of a few nasturtium leaves if you're growing some on your balcony or whatever. Good glug of olive oil, whiz it all up, a bit more olive oil, a bit of seasoning, and maybe a splash of lemon juice or white wine vinegar or apple cider vinegar. Taste it, just your seasoning, and then that's great sauce to serve with chicken or a steak or go over a salad, mix into yogurt, make a dip.
Here's a weird thing about nasturtium. You know how every flower has a Latin botanical name, right? You'd think the Latin name for nasturtium would be nasturtium, but it isn't, unless you're talking about watercress. Watercress is Nasturtium officinale, but nasturtium is Tropiola majus. Is there anything in particular you wanted to mention?
I would just say I really hope people enjoy the book. And I guess I'm quite active on social media or on Instagram at The Edible Flower. And I'm always like keen to answer people's questions and things like that. So if people get the book and have, or even if they don't have the book, but if they have questions or just reflections, I love to hear about what people are doing in other parts of the world. Because obviously we live in a small part of Northern Ireland, and when we were writing the book, the publishers were really keen for us to make it accessible to as wide a market as possible and audience as possible. But I'm always keen to hear if what people are eating in other places, where you were talking about the roses and stuff, what varieties are good there and stuff, because it's just interesting to talk about it and also learn from other people. Yeah. And also people should come and visit if they're in Canada and they're in the, we have loads of events on and we run lots of volunteering sessions and stuff. So if you're in this neck of the woods in Northern Ireland, come and visit us.
The Edible Flower is located in County Down, Northern Ireland. The website is theedibleflower.com. If you're thinking of visiting the farm, definitely look online to see what they're offering when you're there. Right now, they're giving a willow weaving basketry 2-day workshop.
My mum's from Canada, actually.
Is she really?
I haven't been since I was a really small child. She's from Ontario and lived there until she was 15. And then her parents moved back to Northern Ireland. Her mum was from Northern Ireland. Her dad was from England originally. And they moved back to the UK and been on the list for a while because I've now got quite a few friends in Canada and would really like to go and see them.
Oh, where's she from in Ontario?
She moved around a bit. She was in Kitchener for a while and then they were in Toronto. So yeah, a few different places.
If you come, you have to come by Winnipeg.
Okay.
It's only about 2,400 kilometers away.
Now we're going to take a quick break to catch up with Ian at HQ, but we'll be back to hear more from Erin Bunting.
It's a smaller city, so you can't have a lousy restaurant and expect to survive.
Welcome back. In her book, Edible Flowers, Erin uses a flower that I didn't know was edible.
Manitoba. Which is right next to Ontario, but it is still a very long way away.
Well, Erin's mom is a local girl, sort of. It's a small world, isn't it? Thanks for lending us your daughter. Now, I'd love to hear from you, and you can reach me at shauna@pegasuspublications.net. That's S-H-A-U-N-A at pegasuspublications.net. And I'd like to thank Erin Bunting for being my guest today and inspiring me to plant more edible flowers in my garden, and Joe Facer for being Erin's partner in writing this wonderful book, The Edible Flower. I'd also like to thank Yasmin Conception, our producer, Carl Thompson, our graphic designer, Ian Leet, our president, and the Government of Canada for the funding to make Flora and Fauna possible.